my name is Rob, as JP mentioned, and tonight we'll be discussing World War I and tragedy. So it's June 28th, 1914, and if you're living in Europe at this time and you're following the news, then you know that over the last several decades, there have been a number of wars, shifting alliances throughout Europe, and in particular in the Balkans, from 1912 until the summer of 1914, have seen one war after another. Things are completely destabilized. Nobody really would know what was going on. And you hear that the Archduke Franz Ferdinand has been assassinated in Sarajevo. And this sends shockwaves around the world, because he's the heir apparent to the throne of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Over the next 4 to 5 weeks, a chain of events are set off which sees every major power in Europe mobilize for a war that, in a sense, was launched, or at least begun, because of a conflict between Serbia and the Austrians, and somehow ends up involving all these major countries with millions of people dead, many, many more missing, and all of Europe and history is profoundly changed because of this. You can get these details in school. That's not a problem. You know, we learn the dates, we learn about the battles, we learn about the Versailles Treaty afterwards, but from what I can remember of my experience, even in reading that I did on my own about this period when I was younger, the question of why it happened was unresolved. Because sometimes, maybe we don't think about it, but to launch a war of this kind of magnitude, it's not an easy thing. Well, I mean, some of our associates in the U.S. Who did an extensive review of certain elements of Russian history that contributed to the revolution and other events, when they were discussing World War I, noted how often this period of 1914 is likened to a bunch of lunatics standing around a powder keg throwing matches, right, trying to blow this thing up. But these two authors make the point that, in fact, it was more like, or that somebody accidentally set the match throwing. They weren't intending to do it. It just kind of happened. And they say it's more, in fact, like you have a wet keg of gunpowder and a bunch of maniacs sitting around madly trying to set this thing off. And what I've come to discover and what I want to share this evening is that, in fact, to understand why the war happens, you have to go back to, really, 1865. You could go back earlier, I mean, you know, you end up going back to ancient Greece, but we'll stick with this period after the American Civil War and what this means. But before we get into the history, I wanted to discuss somewhat this matter of tragedy, in the sense of classical tragedy like Shakespeare and the Greek tragedians also. Because this can help to understand how it is that, as even today, we're at the point now, and at the end of the class it will become more clear, that we really are on a similar course as the nations of Europe were on in the early years of the 20th century. Tragedy. probably most of you have asked yourself at some point, how in the hell could the United States elect George Bush twice? I mean, this may end up being one of the most profound questions of the 21st century, I don't know. Let's try to wrap our minds around it. It's useful to often look at Shakespeare for this. Like, take Julius Caesar, for example. Julius Caesar, the story of the fall of the Roman Republic. Well, what is the first scene involved? A drunken bunch of Romans just coming back from a party where they were celebrating the death of Pompey and the victory of Caesar. The same people who only a few weeks or months before had been calling for the overthrow of Caesar and cheering on Pompey. Perhaps they had recently been at the Colosseum watching gladiators kill lions or tigers or each other. And what Shakespeare presents you with is the utter degeneracy of Roman society at the time. Because what are the conditions under which Caesar is allowed to take power? And then you start to look, you meet some of the other characters, Brutus and Cassius and the leading men of Rome. And over the course of the play, you come to realize that these guys are just as degenerate as that Roman mob, if not more. And you realize that, holy shit, there's not a single damn person in this play who's any good. They're all a bunch of idiots. The only guy who's any good isn't even in the play, Cicero. Yeah, right. Brutus had his own problems. Everybody in that play suffers from some problem that prevents them from acting at the proper time to actually save the situation. You can look at any of Shakespeare's tragedies and it's the same kind of story. So back to George Bush. Or in general, the political crisis that we've been in for, and economic crisis that we've been in for years. You know, as organizers, we go out on the street and we're talking to people pretty much every day, discussing ideas, what's happening, what they think. And it's a really eye-opening thing because you realize that most people, it's almost like they're in another universe. They actually don't even acknowledge reality. They're not concerned about it one bit. And you could say the most outrageous things to them on the street about fascism or hyperinflation or what Al Gore does to children or whatever, you know? I mean, you can just make anything up that you want. And I mean, maybe 1 out of 100 or 500 people is going to have some kind of reaction. Sometimes it's rage. Like when we put up signs, we had one sign once that said, "Hey Canada, can you say fuck the Queen?" And I think on the second day it got ripped into shreds. Things, you know, you got to wonder if you're following what's happening in the world, how is it that people could be so apathetic that they wouldn't care, or that they wouldn't take the time to stop and talk about what's happening, or how we can solve these problems? Or how many people do you end up meeting who, even if they know what's going on, somehow can't find the strength within themselves to take any action to change what's happening? You know, this is the stuff of tragedy. And it's a recurrent theme through history that civilizations can often lose the moral fitness to survive. You know, like, it's not self-evident that our civilization will always be around. I think human beings will always be around. But our civilization, well, we know that civilizations have disappeared in the past.
What do you mean by civilization?
Well, in the sense of, you know, archaeological evidence that we have of previous... A civilization in the sense of a certain culture... certain ideas, characteristics, beliefs, and so forth. you know, like different civilizations are organized around different ideas. To civilize Africa?
Africa civilized.
Yeah. Well,
where did the Egyptians come from?
True, they were at. So, how do we then ensure that our civilization will always be around? Or at least that we can create the conditions now that in the future, you know, in 50 years or so, when, you know, we'll be passing on the torch of leadership to a new generation, that we will have created the conditions on this planet so that they will be able to, they will be in a better position than we are in now. As opposed to the other alternative, which is that we collapse into a dark age. Now, one thing that one of LaRouche's discoveries is that society itself is organized in the same way that universal gravitation organizes the solar system. In the sense that in human society you have ideas, you could call them axioms or assumed beliefs, self-evident truths, and so forth. Ideas which are unquestioned and yet act as an idea which organizes society. People organize the way that they behave, their personal philosophies, around certain ideas. Like in the West, this was Christianity for 2,000 years, approximately. What Christ introduces, which is really also located in the works of Plato, is that a human being is different from an animal. This principle then was demonstrated through the scientific and artistic breakthroughs that were made by Greece, and were later in European civilization made by Nicholas of Cusa and Johannes Kepler, Gauss and Riemann, a guy named Vladimir Vernadsky, and also LaRouche. And there are many others also. Those are the ones I'm a bit more familiar with. So, this principle, also known as Imago Viva Dei, or man in the image of God, or in the image of the Creator, became the central principle of Western civilization, brought us modern science and brought us the modern nation state. And everything good that we have produced as a civilization has come as a product of that principle being enacted. Now, what happens if those principles which built our civilization are rejected? And you have a population on the street today which doesn't realize that what they believe in, the universe that they believe to exist, doesn't actually exist. I mean, most of us today are taught that tragedy, more of the Nietzschean form, that tragedy really comes through, or art comes as the assertion of one's will, you know, over society, over the universe, over the mob, or whatever. You know, but simply the arbitrary assertion of one's will.
That's like the tragedy?
Yeah, that, in general, I mean, when Nietzsche... Yeah, and this is what's dominated in the schools for a long time.
Is that what art is, or is that what tragedy is?
Well, from what I understand, Nietzsche was writing specifically on tragedy, but I would assume that that he's also applying this to art in general. I mean, think of the modern conception of art as something that's really irrational. It's not something knowable. You're not enacting any kind of principles. It's not it's not reason, because if it was reason, it would be logic, and logic can't be art. It, you know, because logic is science, and these two things are different.
Could it be beyond that?
Beyond reason?
Is including it? Transcending it?
Well, yeah, I think in a sense creativity does transcend logic, yeah. But
it's not before that, that's what it's before logic, but going beyond that. That would be another possibility.
Yeah, it's like the circle to the polygon. So, you know, when we're looking at this society today, you know, to understand why we're in this crisis and why LaRouche talks about a dark age, you have to understand how the assumed beliefs of the society are what's causing the crisis. The corruption of this society. It's not in some guy stealing money or some guy pushing drugs on the street corner. That's not really where the corruption is coming from. It's not in people committing crimes. But it's really in the common conception of one's identity. Or another way of putting it, what is our self-interest?
What is it self?
Well, is it just to get as much pleasure as we can? You know, try to get as much as we can from life while we're here, and then, you know, as George Bush says, he doesn't really care about the future because, or what the future thinks about him because he'll be dead.
That's what he said?
Yeah, something along those lines, yeah.
Thanks for coming out,
George. Yeah. Or, you know, you'll see often people will attack the politicians for being corrupt. And yet, if the population wasn't corrupt, how could we have had those corrupt politicians? If the population hadn't adopted a belief in their own impotence, political impotence, how could a bunch of assholes gotten into office?
Yeah, actually, in single cases, we extract from the systematic happening.
Yeah, I mean, imagine if George Bush had to run against Franklin Roosevelt. I mean,
it would say a man in a wheelchair is not
50%. Well, I think the man in the wheelchair would have kicked Bush's ass. You know, these are the kind of questions that we have to ask ourselves and to understand and to look inside our own minds and say, what within me may be causing the downfall of my own civilization? And to be able to ask that question honestly. Because most people today don't ask that question. See, how this relates to World War I. Because the way society is controlled is through controlling this corruption. You know, if you've got a bunch of people who define their own identity within the bounds of their own existence, of what they can get, well, when push comes to shove, those people are going to turn into cowards. You know, because if you've got some big bad oligarch who says, well, you know, we're going to break your legs and we're going to throw you in a concentration camp or do something nasty to you, people are going to break. They're not going to stand up. Even if they have some decent principles, they're not going to find the strength to face up to that, because they're going to be more terrified about death than about doing what is right. Then they're concerned about doing what's right, not terrified about doing what's right. And the Venetians understood this, and the British understand this. This is their method. You find, read Othello, The Moor of Venice, if you want to understand how the British Empire continues to exist as an empire. Have some of you read that play before? Othello? You got this guy, Iago, who's a deceiver. And he wants to destroy this guy, Othello, this great general. What he does is he profiles Othello, and he finds out what Othello's weakness is. It's jealousy. And he's got a tendency towards rage. And he figures out how he can provoke that jealousy and rage. And he twists, and he twists, and he twists, and he twists, and he pushes and pushes until he breaks Othello. And in the end, most people are dead. And this is the British method, and this is what they're doing today. That's why, you know, I would pose the question, when does a war begin? Did World War I begin with the declarations of war in 1914? Did it begin with the assassination of Archduke Ferdinand? Most people would probably assume yes. But in fact, the war really began maybe as early as 1890. Or maybe it really began when Lincoln was victorious over the Confederacy. The intention to destroy the United States and destroy Eurasia as a response to that victory. Now, another reason why it's important to revisit this right now, not only because we have this drive that's going on, but to help people to conceptualize how they can be in a process, a war dynamic, okay, even though the war hasn't started. And to understand that you can have a policy to create a war that may be on the agenda for several decades. There may be attempts, like we know Cheney trying to get wars going with Iran, but they don't work. Does that mean that Cheney gives up on a war against Iran? Or a general war in Eurasia? No. Maybe he's been foiled once or twice. We played a role in a few of those times. Well, it's mostly through Cheney's wife and her connections in London, and also through certain corporations in the military-industrial complex, as they call it, like Lockheed Martin and so forth.
Yes.
So, to begin with here, the thing is, why did the British intend to orchestrate this war? What was the threat? You know, oligarchs don't like to do a whole lot. They're pretty lazy.
Right.
They like to sit around and play golf and...
Was
threatened? Yeah. Yeah, this is the thing. Now, what were they threatened by? And that's where you have to look at what was going on in the United States. Is that big enough? So, in 1876, an event occurred in Philadelphia, Centennial Exhibition, when all the world came together to really in a celebration of the U.S. Republic. And this was also, in a sense, the coming out party for the U.S. As an industrial and world power. And I have a few pictures here of the elements of this display and some other figures. Now, Henry C. Carey was the leading world economist in the 19th century, but you won't learn about him in most economics courses. And Friedrich List was a collaborator with Carey and other patriotic circles in the United States. And Germany today, modern Germany, really exists because of the work that List was doing around industrializing Germany, creating the economic conditions which Bismarck could then further in order to bring about the unification of Germany by the latter part of the 19th century. These were the guys that were writing the books that were denouncing free trade, that were creating the economic basis for a global revolution in economics. of what is known as the American system explicitly. You know, you had people at this convention like Thomas Edison, who invented the light bulb. He's over here, and Emil Rathenau, who went back to Germany and started up, started electrifying Germany. And, you know, these guys were some of the most important inventors and industrialists of their time. And they were at this convention. This is the... We should have to move a little bit. this is, I believe this is called the Corliss engine. And in Machinery Hall, which is one part of this exhibition, they had this massive machine, thousands of horsepower, totally silent. It took something like 50 rail cars to transport all of the parts to Philadelphia. I can't remember exactly where it was built. I think maybe New York or Boston.
Did you say totally silent?
Yeah, it was. This thing was massive. It's called the Corliss engine. There'll be another picture of it coming up. It was named after the inventor of it. This is Machinery Hall. So all of these, all the different nations that were there, were bringing their machine tools, you know, new inventions, and they were setting them up, and then showing them off to other countries. So it was like a giant exposition of technological progress. You know, and everybody was coming there. I mean, you had Mendeleev coming from Russia, you know, the great chemist, who actually at the time was more known for his advocacy of railroading and economic development. You know, here's the front view of the Corliss engines. Well, it was a giant engine that would power all of the other machinery in that machinery hall. They had one giant generator, essentially. I'm not exactly sure how the whole thing worked. But that's at the opening day. But these are the engines here. I mean, this thing is huge.
Everything worked on valves at that point?
Yeah, probably, yeah. That's the first monorail, I believe. This is not a very good picture.
It doesn't look very aerodynamic.
No. Well, I don't think it was going too fast. Revolutionary. So, these are some of the different expositions that were there. You know, France, Egypt, Germany, China, Brazil. And everybody was trying to outdo each other and
show off.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it was a really patriotic event. You know, nations coming together. You know, to actually celebrate human nature.
I did see about spies.
Pardon?
There were also some spies.
Some spying? Maybe. But I think it was more sharing. I mean, these guys would come and... I mean, there would be a lot of deals that would be made on sharing technologies and business deals. Country people going back with new ideas for their own countries. You know, it was out of this kind of exposition, really, that the idea of the Trans-Siberian Railway came. You know, and seeing the amount of railroading that had been built up in the United States. And in the years afterwards, you had this whole project. These are proposed rail lines for China. You know, and this line here, that would tie into the Trans-Siberian Railway. So you had Americans that were working with the Chinese government. And later, you know, the first Chinese Republic established in 1911 by a guy named Sun Yat-sen, who had been educated in Hawaii by American missionaries and other, you know, patriotic individuals. And he went to China And he still recognized, you can't say anything bad about Sun Yat-sen in China. That's a no-no. Because he's seen as the real father of China. You had here a line that becomes strategically of great importance later on, which is known as the Berlin to Baghdad Railway, which was to run down here through the Austro-Hungarian Empire, through the Balkans, through Constantinople, down to Baghdad. And this project was launched in 1889. And as you can see, the color part, the solid line is what was actually built. Unfortunately, for various political reasons, it was not completed all the way to Baghdad. And Germany was working with the Ottoman Empire to open up the interior of the continent, but also so it could access the petroleum of the northern regions of Iraq. The British hated that idea. You know, but the Germans, they even tried to bring in the British banks to help finance it and be involved in its construction. But they wouldn't have any of that. This is the Trans-Siberian Railway. You know, going from St. Petersburg. This thing is 5,400 miles long. It's a massive undertaking. I mean, when from 1892 to 1902, the Russians, who previously had only built a few hundred miles of railroads, in like the 5 or 10 years beforehand, they laid like 14,000 miles of railroad in 10 years. I mean, it's just unbelievable how fast they were building this thing. Now, so what you have around the world, oh yeah, you also have, although this is actually, you know, it's a really bad map. I have another one that people can take a look at it later if they want. But what this is a this is a map of a proposal that was done by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, or U.S. Army engineer anyway, for an intercontinental railway between that would connect the North America to South America. And there's a red line, which is very hard to see, but I'll try to trace it out, going from really from Mexico City up in here, down through the Isthmus, coming over here into Colombia, Venezuela, and then down this side through Chile and Peru, crossing over the Alps, or sorry, the Andes, also going all the way down to the capital of Chile, which is here, I think, and going over into Paraguay and so forth. What's interesting, although it's very difficult to see, are the railroads that were already built. Now, yeah, let me do this, because you'll understand, like, colonialism, what the real problem is with colonialism, or one of the problems. And this was also the case in Africa. Take, for example, you see, there's our transcontinental. This is before Laurier built the second one. So you can see here, okay, this area, look at those. What the hell is that? Like little scribbles on the edge of the map. There's a bit more around Rio de Janeiro.
Those are railroads, right?
Those are little railroads, yeah. Now, what the hell is that doing there? Seems kind of strange, huh? Well, that would have been built by the British or the French or the Spanish. That's the railroad that goes from the port to the mine. That's what that is. That's British economic development.
Extraction.
Yeah.
Maybe it's in on the other side as well.
Yeah, you can see it all along here, up here. I mean, right. So you had this plan to just, you know, you got these Americans around Henry C. Carey in 18. in the mid 1860s, the late 1860s, they're already talking about getting across the Bering Strait with a tunnel. Well, not a tunnel at that time. They're talking about a bridge. But their plan was, you know, we're going to have an alliance with Russia to industrialize the whole world, and we're going to screw over the British and the French, you know, the empires of that time. We're going to defeat these guys through developing the human population of this planet and putting them in a position where they're no longer dependent upon British banking, British merchant marine, and so forth, or the British Navy for, you know, quote-unquote, protection. You know, it's funny, I recently learned that the, you know, British ships either had to pay no or just very little insurance in order to, you know, be safe on the seas. But other nations, they had extraordinary rates of insurance to pay for protection from pirates and all those nasty characters that are out there that can accost you on your travels.
Mafia.
Yeah. Of course, you know, the biggest mafia of all was in London. And then, of course, one of the greatest threats to the British was the consolidation of Germany. Well, I want to read a couple short quotes here on this question, because because here's the thing, right? You gotta understand, the British Empire was a maritime-based empire, right? Their power was in controlling the oceans, preventing overland development. You know, all trade. I mean, think about it. If you're in St. Petersburg and you want to go to Vladivostok in 1850, you're either going to have to travel on a British ship, or you're going to be paying tolls, in a sense, to get there. You know, at the main ports along the route, which are all mostly controlled by the Brits. So, you know, Russia then, you think about what is the potential for Russia as a sovereign nation to be independent of the goodwill of the British Empire, or any other nation, really, that wants to trade or you want to get your people moving around and so forth. And I'll show you a couple maps later of the kind of the choke points, the maritime choke points and naval bases that the British controlled. You didn't realize, holy shit, you couldn't move in the 18th or 19th century without the goodwill of the Brits. So this empire then, you start to think about the overland development of nations and continents and how this totally revolutionizes global politics. Because now the entire basis for British global hegemony is threatened. And in particular, it was threatened by these three guys and others that were around them in their circles. This is Sergei Vita. He was the finance minister of Russia from 1892 to 1903. And he was the main guy that got the Trans-Siberian Railroad built. Otto von Bismarck, instead of the Chancellor of Germany, who united Germany, but also brought in the policies of Friedrich List, the guy from earlier, who... Bismarck, who united Germany, brought in the policies of Friedrich List, and turned Germany in the course of a few decades into the most powerful nation in Europe, industrially. By 1914, Germany was outproducing Britain in literally everything. Shipping, steel, iron, coal production, all this kind of stuff. And Britain, throughout this period, from like 1873 to the end of the century, was in a deep depression. I mean, their economy was tanking. And they're seeing all these major nations around the world adopting policies, American system policies. So, and at the same time, nobody liked the British. Especially these three guys. And they were consciously enacting policies that would free their nations from British control and manipulation. The guy on the far end here, his name is Gabriel Haniteau, and he was the foreign minister of France for a number of years, from about 1894 to 1898, roughly, in France. And he had all kinds of ideas about how to build up railroading in Africa. And he was also working with Sergei Witte on solidifying relations between France and Russia. He was also talking with Germany about getting a continental alliance, that's what they called it, to isolate the British. Because they recognized that their common interest was in working together for continental development. Now, some people didn't like that idea. Now, some people you don't have to insult.
Empress of India.
Mm-hmm.
Who's that?
That's Victoria.
Vicky?
Vicky, yeah.
Where's her smile?
Well, she hadn't smoked her opium. So she's feeling a little bit down.
She was
actually,
she was on opium.
Yeah, for a long time.
Wearing off.
Long time.
Wearing off.
Yeah. Yep.
Is that Elizabeth's mother?
I don't think so. Maybe grandma.
Yeah.
But, you know, we're not really so concerned with her, but she ruled the empire for a long time. And these are the maps. Now, you know, during her period, up to the end of the century, these are all naval bases. These are British naval bases. Now, it's kind of hard to make out the map, but... that's part of it. But again, you know, you think about if you want to go from, you know, Vladivostok or up here, and you want to go around, well, you know, these ships need to restock their coal supplies and so forth along the way. Well, all of the major ports where you could do that have one of these little red stars on them. So, you know, this is this is how the British maintained their empire. It was not... People make the mistake of thinking that the Brits were somehow... the default version of the British Empire was with giant continental acquisitions and huge armies and stuff like that, but that's not really the way that they ran things. What they recognized pretty early on, was that it was much more efficient to simply indebt a nation, and by controlling all of their trade or their access to the outside world, you turn these countries into de facto colonies without having to occupy them. They called this the informal empire, which is really the way that the British had always run things since the late 17th century. Now this one is of the strategic points mostly. You can see again, whether it's Gibraltar, the Suez Canal, the opening to the Red Sea, also the opening to, later they move into Iran. You've got Canada covered, you've got the Falkland Islands, you've got the Straits of Malacca, you've got Hong Kong, you've also got Shanghai.
What is that for you?
Well, major trading routes?
Choke points,
yeah. Also South Africa, the same thing. So this was the strategic orientation of the British Empire. Now this is a maritime empire. The worst thing that could possibly happen in the eyes of these guys is that you could start to move goods from here across to China and so forth in a fraction of the time and more cheaply. And there would be nothing that the British military could do to stop that from happening, because it's so far inland. The same thing with Germany building its railroad down into the Middle East. And the British recognized this. If, for example, you had a fellow who, he was working, a guy named Laffin, R.G.D. Laffin, who was a senior British military advisor attached to the Serbian army in the early 1900s. And he was discussing the threat of the Berlin-Baghdad railway. And he says, if Berlin-Baghdad were achieved, a huge block of territory producing every kind of economic wealth and unassailable by sea power would be united under German authority. Russia would be cut off from this barrier, by this barrier from her Western friends, Great Britain and France. German and Turkish armies would be within easy striking distance of our Egyptian interests. And from the Persian Gulf, our Indian Empire would be threatened. The port of Alexandretta and the control of the Dardanelles, that is the seaway between going from the Black Sea to the Mediterranean, would soon give Germany enormous naval power in the Mediterranean. A glance at the map of the world will show how the chain of states stretched from Berlin to Baghdad. The German Empire, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, Bulgaria, Turkey, one little strip of territory alone blocked the way and prevented the two ends of the chain from being linked together. That little strip was Serbia. Serbia stood small but defiant between Germany and the great ports of Constantinople and Salonika, holding the gate of the East. Serbia was really the first line of defense in our eastward, in our eastern possessions. If she were crushed or enticed into the Berlin-Baghdad system, then our vast but slightly defended empire would soon have felt the shock of Germany's eastward thrust.
Who's writing that?
A guy named Laffin, who is a military advisor to the Serbian army.
Advising them not to go with it?
Yeah, well...
Because why did Serbia...
But he said our vast but defended.
Yeah, because he's a Brit. He's writing on what he's writing on is the threat posed by this Berlin to Baghdad road, this overland development to the British imperial interests. Mm-hmm.
Why would Serbia want to go along with something like that?
Well, there's a number of reasons, which we're going to get at. Yes and no. I mean, it was they'd been controlled by the Ottomans for hundreds of years, but we're gonna get at that in a minute, because it's a complicated thing. What's going on in the Balkans? Just like today, it hasn't gotten any less complicated in 100 years. Now, there is also another fellow who is a within the foreign affairs. Sector in London, and he was talking about the Trans-Siberian project. His name was Holcomb. Well, he's another Brit, and he's voicing the opinion of the British Foreign Office about the Trans-Siberian. This line will not only be one of the greatest trade routes that the world has ever known, but it will also become a political weapon in the hands of the Russians, whose power and significance it is difficult to estimate. It will make a single nation out of Russia, for whom it will no longer be necessary to pass through the Dardanelles or through the Suez Canal. It will give her an economic independence through which she will become stronger than she has ever been or ever dreamed of becoming. So,
what are you thinking?
This is a book called Century of War. Very, very good book. Although, his name is William Engel.
Engel?
Engel. Yeah. You can borrow it if you want. It's It's hard to find, but it's quite good. So this is what the British are thinking. Now, what is going to be their response? Well, it just so happened at that time, you had this guy waiting in the wings, who was to become King Edward VII, who took the throne in 1901, I believe. Now, this guy is considered by many to be the greatest English king since William the Conqueror.
The son of Victoria?
The son of, yes, Victoria. Now, what did he do to become, to gain that kind of a reputation? Now, King Edward VII, probably more than any other individual, deserves to be called the architect of World War I. But that works also.
I thought you were going to say that.
That's the guy you see in front of the base.
Yeah.
With all the face full of bird shit.
Yeah. Yeah, he's not looking so good these days. The pigeons aren't respecting him so much.
He's also facing Queen Victoria.
Yeah, that's right.
At the music school.
Mm-hmm.
Where did this go?
Yeah. Well, we're going to get into that because, see, he comes into power around 1900. Now, just where we stand right now, because even though he becomes king in 1901, he's been around for a long time. In fact, he paid a little visit to the United States in 1861. Coincidentally, the Civil War broke out very soon after that. He also visited Canada around that time. And he was very active. In fact, we weren't actually allowed to become a nation, independent, until people like MacDonald and Cartier and some of the other, and George Brown and so forth, had met personally with him and his inner elite, you could say, about 100 of the leading oligarchs in London, and had made certain concessions on free trade and the control of the English economy. So this guy was really, and it's recognized that he ran British foreign affairs, the Foreign Office. He ran the British government and the empire. It's very rare that it's ever the monarch who actually is the leading oligarch in the British Empire, but this guy was. He was involved in getting the Japanese to launch a 50-year war against China in 1895. He was personally involved in orchestrating wars around Europe, and so forth. Very likely, the assassination of Sadi Carnot in France in 1894, he was involved in this, and so forth. But we're going to look at a few of his, what he did. Now, it's important to note also that Edward VII was the protege of Lord Palmerston, who was the chief architect of the American Civil War. In the sense that he organized the Confederacy, the British were arming them, they were building the ships for the Confederate Navy, and so forth. Yeah, this is Lord Palmerston. And he was a really public enemy number one in the eyes of Henry C. Carey and the American Patriots. Now, he's got this very famous quote that nations have no permanent friends or allies, they only have permanent interests. Well, in the case of the British, it's you see this view because, I mean, their alliances will shift back and forth. Whenever they need to be allied with somebody, they will get that alliance. If they don't need them anymore, they'll be dumped in a minute. But what you're seeing here is a certain geopolitical perspective that we're just in this is politics is about manipulation. We don't really care about anybody else, just ourselves, and we'll do whatever is necessary to survive and defend or increase our power.
So, when he's saying that he's not attacking this idea of a nation. He's considering Britain to be a nation.
Yeah, well, I think it expresses his own philosophical outlook on international relations and the purpose of nations and so forth. You know, this is also the guy that was, involved in organizing these two opium wars against China. You know, the British fought these wars to force China to accept British opium. Of course, for the good of the Chinese people. Hmm? Yeah. Yeah. Well, remember there's this quote from Kerry where he... in one of Henry C. Carey's books, he cites an article that Palmerston had written in one of the British papers, where Palmerston's gleefully talking about the coming breakup of the United States and how the northern states were going to join Canada and the southern states would become a slave-owning nation and so forth. You know, so he was openly talking. That was in 1857. He was openly writing about that. And there's all kinds of other stuff. You know, if people want to look into it more, they can read a book by Anton Chaffin called Treason in America, which details that more in depth, how this was, the Civil War was provoked. But now, King Edward VII had a few friends. In particular, although they may not have wanted me to use that word, but... we have these two guys here, Willie and Nicky, Cousin Willie and Cousin Nicky, two of the biggest idiots in Europe. And again, you know, this is this question of tragedy that, and Europe is still not recovered from this, that they're continuously governed by idiots. Even today, the leadership of Europe, a bunch of idiots. Totally incompetent. Just like these two. Now, you can read this quote down below. Edward VII made an in-depth study of the defects of Wilhelm II. He counted them as his most precious allies.
The defects?
The defects, yeah. Because Edward VII was essentially a Venetian. He had mastered... See, he was related to most of the monarchs in Europe. You know, these two guys were King Edward VII's nephews. And he knew them like the back of his hand, both of them, yeah.
One was the Tsar of Russia?
Yeah, and one was... Yeah, this is the Kaiser of Germany, Kaiser Wilhelm II, and you have Tsar Nicholas II of Russia. Both of them were, for the most part, neurotic. And, see, what Edward VII knew was that nephew Willie, the only thing he wanted in the world was to be accepted by the British royals. He would do anything to be friends with them, to be accepted and liked. And King Edward VII used that over and over again to manipulate these guys. Even at the end of World War I, when Germany had been defeated, Wilhelm was known to have still been boasting about how in 1901 he had helped save the British and Britain's reputation in the world during the Boer War. When Britain had been totally isolated, nobody liked them. You know, nobody liked King Edward VII. Everybody thought he was a bastard. And I came and I helped save Britain. I came to their rescue and I was their friend. Even after recognizing that it had been King Edward who had brought about the collapse and the destruction of Germany. So. Total idiot. Right, then you had a bunch of these clowns who were all agents of Edward VII. Theodore Roosevelt, the president, Sir Edward Grey. These two guys were leaders in France. These two guys were leaders in Russia. And Sir Edward Grey took over from Edward VII when Edward died in 1910. And Roosevelt, of course, played a role also in bringing the United States into what's known now as the Anglo-American special relationship. Okay? Now, 1901, there's a problem for the British because they're isolated. They're in this Boer war, this brutal war down in South Africa. They're getting their asses kicked. Nobody likes them. In fact, there had been discussions at the time between Germany, Russia, and France of getting together and actually declaring war on Britain to just finish them off. So this is, I mean, you're talking about an existential crisis for the British Empire. So it's at this point that Edward goes to Kaiser Wilhelm and starts to talk about an Anglo-German treaty. And the idiot falls for it. And he starts to get in bed with the British and says, forget about the French and the Russians. We're going to let them do their thing, and we're going to go with the British because, you know, they're good people. The point being that when Britain was isolated and there was a threat of this so-called Continental Alliance coming into fruition in order to, you know, wage a war against the British at the time, Edward VII was able to manipulate Kaiser Wilhelm II into abandoning this Continental Alliance and siding with the British, only a few short years later to be dumped again. But, right, nations have no permanent friends, only permanent interests. Now, I think it's important at this point that there's a question of geopolitics. But also understand what it is that we're dealing with Edward VII and the way that he's thinking as he's going to go into the next 10 years or so leading up to World War I. Does somebody want to read this?
Yeah. Tertius Gaudens. If all this form of divide and impera, the instigation of positive struggle between two elements, may have its purpose in the relation of the third party to either of these two, or to an object existing outside of them. Latter occurs in case one of the three candidates for an office understands how to instigate the two others against each other, in such a way that by gossip and slander, which each of them sets in motion against the other, they spoil each other's chances. In all cases of this type of art of the third shows itself in the degree of the distance at which he is wise enough to place himself from the action which he instigates. The more he guides the conflict by merely invisible threads, the more he understands how to tend the fire so that it continues to burn without his further assistance and observation. The sharper and more direct will be the struggle between the other two until their reciprocal ruin is accomplished. But more than that, the price of the struggle at stake between them, or the objects otherwise of value to the third party, will seem to fall into his lap of themselves. In this technique, too, the Venetians were masters. George Simpson.
Questions about that?
Who is Tertius?
The third who benefits.
Tertius or Gaudens?
Divide et impera is divide and conquer.
Divide imperialism.
Yeah. Okay.
Looking up to the Venetians.
Gossip? Well, that's, if you're talking behind somebody else's back, or you're—I mean, just watch a soap opera. And
that's
then you'll understand gossip and slander. Or if you read Iago about Iago in Othello and the way that Iago operates, it's all gossip and slander.
Backbiting.
Yeah, you're lying about other people. You're manipulating them through false information or maybe even true information. Okay.
Media, the news.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So the point is that this has been the model of, it was the model of the Venetian Empire in the past. It was also the model of the British Empire. And it's important to understand that because the way history is presented is usually other people fighting. The thing is, who's orchestrating the fight? Like today, people talk about the American Empire. Well, no. You got to look at who's orchestrating these conflicts. Okay. Now, what Edward sets out to do. Okay. So you got to think also here about how the future is determining the present. Edward and his cadre, they want a general European war. Because what they want to do is destroy both Germany and Russia. Because these are the continental threats to British power. Now, how are you going to do that? Because on the continent, you have this tendency within certain circles in Germany, France, and Russia to come together around development. So you've got to break that up. And what he settles on is, okay, we are going to isolate, we're going to encircle Germany and destroy Germany. That's the primary objective. This is decided upon as early as 1890 that Germany will be the target. Okay? Over the course of the 1890s, the first focus is on France. Edward VII takes certain measures. Now you have the assassination of Sadi Carnot, who is a patriot who is interested in development. He's working with the circles of this guy, Hanotaux. Now, Edward also understands something else in this devious mind of his. What he understands is this Venetian method of manipulation. So now, you have this guy, Emile Furon, who had been in the French civil service, I think in the Foreign Office. And he wrote a book on this whole period of history. And he wrote that Edward's empire was built on eternal human folly. You know, he built himself upon his profound knowledge of the human heart and the sagacity with which he could sort out the vices and weaknesses of individuals and peoples and make these into the worst and most destructive of weapons against them. Okay? This is a guy named Emile Furon. Yeah. A difficult name. About, he wrote this book in 1906, La France Conquise. La France Conquise. He's writing this about Edward VII. He then goes on, now this is a paraphrase section. Furon praised Edward's practical understanding of French ideology. Edward knew how to exploit the chauvinism of the Alsace-Lorraine Revanchard to incite France against Germany. There's a certain faction in France that hated the Germans because in 1871, Germany had annexed part of France, Alsace, the provinces of Alsace and Lorraine. And that was never forgiven. Well, that, I don't want to get into that right now. And there was a war, a Franco-Prussian war at the time. I don't even know all the details of it. But what I do know is you had a faction in France that became, really, the Revanchard, that translated, I believe, as the guys who want revenge.
Yeah.
Right. And so he knew how to employ. Now these guys I showed earlier, Clemenceau and Delcassé, these two guys were the leaders of the Revanchard faction in France.
They were trying to get back at Germany?
Yeah, so they hated the Germans. So he worked to bring these guys into power. He knew how to play upon the fascination of the Russian Slavophiles with the Greater Serbia agitation in the Balkans. He had this faction in Russia that believed that it was Russia's destiny to be the third Rome. And they had this fixation, this wild fixation on conquering Constantinople and meddling in the Balkans. And he understood that. And he used that, as we'll see later. He knew how to use the hatred of the Italian irredentisti against Austria to detach Italy from the pro-German triple alliance of Italy, Austro-Hungary, and Germany. He knew how to drive wedges between Germany and Austria by evoking Vienna's resentment of the 1866 war and Prussian preeminence and their fear of Serbia. He could exploit an American's racist eagerness to be, like the king, a member of a mythical Anglo-Saxon race, that is Theodore Roosevelt. He could use the aspirations of Japanese militarists for the greater glory of the British Empire. Much of Edward's personal magnetism was exercised during his incessant state visits, where he was able to unleash highly orchestrated outbursts of Bertie mania. He was known as Bertie. Prince Bertie. So over the course of the 1890s, you have something that's very famous in France. It's known as the Dreyfus Affair. And you have a French captain is accused of being a German spy. And this is blown up into a huge scandal that is used by this revenge group, the Revanchard, to create this gap, this break with Germany, okay, over European policy. A couple of years later, in 1898, the British and the French faced off at a place called Fashoda in Sudan. And the issue is the control of Egypt. And the armies, they kind of stand off with each other for some time, and eventually the French back down. And what's happened is that Edward VII has cut a deal with a bunch of his cronies in France, and they agree that France will be the second power, and that they're going to divide up Africa. The Brits say, okay, listen, France, we're going to take Egypt, because, you know, we've got an army there, and we're not going to leave. But what we'll do, we'll give you Morocco. We'll give you control over, you know, northern Africa. Knowing that Germany had a rival claim to Morocco. Now, Edward VII then goes to Kaiser Wilhelm and gets and through some of his agents around Wilhelm, he manages to convince Wilhelm to make a trip to Morocco in 1905, and we almost get World War I in 1905. Because Wilhelm makes this trip, then Edward's agents within the French government, Delcassé and Clemenceau, start agitating for a war against Germany because, you know, our interests in Morocco are being threatened. And we almost got the war then. But saner heads managed to intervene and keep it from happening. There's a second Morocco crisis in 1911 where the same thing almost happened. Now, because of some of this stuff, what happens is Edward VII is able to seduce France into what becomes known as the Entente Cordiale. Now take note. Now what this was a treaty between France and Britain against Germany, specifically against Germany. And the deal again was that the British would back up French claims in Africa, and also France's claim to Alsace-Lorraine.
For what?
And in return, more guarantees on British naval superiority and also regarding Egypt. Okay. But this is, so this is the thing. So Britain has now gone from an alignment with Germany to an alignment with France in just a couple of years. But the thing is, look at what they do. They say, they push France towards another confrontation with Germany over Alsace-Lorraine. They structure their agreements with already knowing that they're going to try to push these buttons to get the war going. Okay? Now, take note that Nicolas Sarkozy, the current president of France, recently made a trip to London. And guess what he announced?
French will send their troops to...
Well, he did that, but something more important. A new Entente Cordiale. Now, he might be, you know, a bit of a jackass, but there is no way. Now, even if he did not know, understand the implications of what he said, the people that told him to say that did. Yeah. Whom the Pope wouldn't even meet with. Said, she's too dirty. Yeah, well, he refused. He met with Sarkozy, but he refused to meet with his bimbo. Yeah. Because she's got a reputation. I mean, he's not going to meet with loose hussies.
So I have a question. Did he clarify the Entente Cordiale?
Well, the Entente Cordiale was an alliance between France and Britain against Germany. And that Britain made certain agreements on backing up the French in their claim to Alsace-Lorraine. I can't remember some of the other details in terms of what the British got out of it.
In return for what?
Yeah. But that was the key thing right here is this Alsace-Lorraine question. Because that was the primary wedge between Germany and France. So they make sure that is always on the front burner. Now, so one step has been taken, but the encirclement is not complete.
But when was Britain really in an explicit alliance with Germany before that?
Well, no, they weren't in an explicit alliance, but even Edward had been making overtures to the Kaiser. He'd been trying to get him on board, but he never intended really to get into an alliance with Germany. He'd already been planning to destroy Germany, but he needed to use Germany in order to prevent this continental alliance from coming together. That's the point. Now, Germany didn't know about this Entente Cordiale, of course. Well, I'm not sure. I think it changed hands a number of times. Before 1870, it had belonged to France. I don't know, maybe during the Prussian War, before it had changed hands also around the time of, after the Napoleonic Wars. But yeah, Nicholas here would know more specifically on that. There's a point of contention. And I think after World War I, France re-annexed Alsace-Lorraine. I believe. Mm-hmm.
Do you have a theory on what the common enemy and the present Entente Cordiale?
The common enemy of the Entente Cordiale is China and Russia.
In what way did Britain use Germany?
Well, he convinced the Kaiser that Britain, that he wanted an alliance with Germany. And the Kaiser, being an Anglophile, right, he was obsessed with the British. I mean, you know, and there's these funny stories apparently about, I mean, Edward, he would sometimes punch the Kaiser in the face and like knock him down or insult him and do all kinds of nasty stuff because he knew how to push his buttons. And this guy would just keep taking it, and it wouldn't matter what Edward would say. I mean, the Kaiser was just always fawning over him. And like even at the end of the war, after the Kaiser knows that he's been ruined by Edward VII from beyond the grave, he still is so pleased with himself that he had helped Edward out in their you know, in 1900, 1901. So the thing was to prevent this alliance from developing between the three major European powers against Britain at that time, knowing, though, that he planned to destroy Germany by encircling it and getting into an alliance with France and Russia primarily. So, and also, you know, take 1901, right, you get the assassination of McKinley, which is organized by these same guys, which brings in Teddy Roosevelt, which becomes important later for the financing of the war. So, at this point, Edward's got part of his alliance together. The next thing is to get Russia. And by 1907, he has gotten, you know, these two guys, Izvolsky and Sasanov, into an alliance. Even after, well, and part of this is really a, see, in 1905, or 1904, the British had convinced the Japanese, had gotten into a military alliance with Japan, and said, look, you know, you guys are an island nation, we're an island nation, we're both empires, you should dominate this whole region of Asia. So what we'll do, because we want to be your friends, if you decide to go to war against any particular powers in your area, we will ensure that nobody else interferes. And so they made an agreement which that the Japanese would go to war against Russia in 1904. And the Japanese managed to destroy the Russian Navy in a surprise attack, and then a war that cost tens of thousands of lives. It was really brutal out in eastern Russia. And this in part, I mean, Russia was wrecked. Then you had this revolution in 1905. So Russia was a total disaster, and this pushed the Russian Tsar into this alliance with the British, simply out of desperation. However, the Brits again, or Edward, knowing his obsession with Constantinople, really the treaty, for the most part, is about spheres of influence. And Edward says to the Russians, look, we will back up your claims over Constantinople and the Balkans. You stay out of our business in India and Afghanistan, so forth. You honor our domination there, and we will back you up in your quest to become the Third Rome. And these guys fell for it. So by 1907, the encirclement is essentially complete. In the next year or two, he also manages to get Italy on board. Italy, which had been aligned with Germany and Austria. So you have a situation by, like, 1910, when Edward dies, where you have a four-power alliance against Austro-Hungary, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and Germany on the continent. Now, you have this funny story, though, about these guys, because, you know, the nephews were not so dumb that they didn't know that they were both being played. This is where you start to understand tragedy. Even when people know that they're being screwed, they often can't find the will or the strength to stop getting screwed. And the Kaiser and the Tsar met at a point around 1905, 1906, roughly. And they met on this boat, apparently. And the Kaiser wrote a letter back to his prime minister, or his chancellor, and this is what he said. Our talk then turned on England, and it very soon appeared that the Tsar feels a deep personal anger at England and the king. He called Edward VII the greatest mischief maker and the most dangerous and deceptive intriguer in the world. I could only agree with him, adding that I especially had had to suffer from his intrigues in recent years. He has a passion for plotting against every power, of making a little agreement. Whereupon the Tsar interrupted me, striking the table with his fist. Well, I can only say, he shall not get one from me, and never in my life against Germany or you, my word of honor upon it. So the Kaiser then proposed that the two cousins join in a little agreement of their own to stymie Edward. The Tsar accepted and signed a draft treaty of mutual defense, which the Kaiser pulled from his pocket. The two tearfully pledged friendship. But these two borderline psychotics were unable to imagine a community of principle based on economic development, since that would have contradicted oligarchism. Anyway. So the Kaiser returns to Germany and he says, look, okay, we're going to have an agreement with the Russians. And I think his chancellor then... he threatened to resign, and then the Kaiser threatened to commit suicide. It's just a soap opera. But anyway, the thing falls apart because, you know, there's all these agents around the Kaiser who want to prevent any kind of alliance between Russia and Germany. And within about a year after this happens, you get the Anglo-Russian Entente. But here's what's interesting, right? This war starts. So you've now got this alignment of powers. You've got everything set up for a big war. We know that any one of these powers, whether France, Germany, you know, anybody gets involved in some conflict, it's going to bring everybody else in. But the British don't go at it by trying to provoke a direct war between any of the two major powers. They go with, JP called a few weeks ago, this breakaway ally tactic, like Israel today kind of represents for the United States. And they go to the Balkans. And the Balkans are really messed up. Okay. Around pre-1815, or roughly, this is 1820. This is the situation in the Balkans. The Ottoman Empire is still pretty big. You got the Austro-Hungarian Empire here. You got all kinds of different ethnic groups in this area, but they've been ruled by the Ottomans for 400 years or so. Okay, now, over the course of the 19th century, many things happen. And around 1870, approximately, this is the case. You now have... there have been a few wars. There's a big war between Russia and the Ottoman Empire, which led to the establishment of Serbia. I think Montenegro was already around, but it's bigger now. Bulgaria, Romania. And also Greece. There's a revolution in Greece in the 1820s. But the key thing here, now, if you look at how these various ethnic groups are dispersed, I mean... you're going to see pockets all over the place, and we know that from today with what's happening there. You've got different ethnic groups all over the place. You know, it's a total mess in that sense. When you're trying to establish a nation, the place has been manipulated because of this for centuries. Because of what you had at this time, and this is really wild. Well, because you had the Serbs, the Bulgarians, and the Greeks, okay, with their three countries, and this map is a little bit hard to make out, but the point being, okay, you have these nations. Now, you got to go back to the British. Because in 1903, you had something set up in London called the Balkan Committee, or the Balkan Committee, set up by the Parliament. And run by a bunch of very nice fellows who were simply concerned with the state of affairs in the Balkans. And interestingly enough, many of them happened to be leading oligarchs. And they all had their favorite. One guy, he was really close to the what became known as the Greater Serbia Movement, which is a bunch of Serbian imperialists who wanted to expand to what were defined vaguely as kind of the historical boundaries of, you know, the Serbian Empire 400 years ago, right? Which was like all of this region. You had another Brit who was very close and was helping to organize the Greater Bulgaria Movement. And the Greater Bulgarian Movement, they claimed control over a territory like this. Right. Another guy was involved with the Greater Greece Movement. And Greece, they were pretty, ambitious. They were claiming this whole region. Okay? But the Brits were also backing another group called the Young Turk Movement. And in 1908, the Young Turks organized a coup and became the and started running the Ottoman Empire. And the Young Turks came in with saying freedom and equality for everybody, and then turned around and started ethnic cleansing everything. You know, they ran a genocide against the Armenians. They were running operations against all of these various groups, who the Greeks, the Serbians, the Bulgarians, who had actually backed the Young Turks in their coup attempt because they were saying equality for everybody. But of course, everybody was being run by the British, so it makes some sense there. Now, the thing is, all of these powers are claiming sovereignty over Macedonia, of course. And you now, can you see how it would be a rather simple thing to start to organize wars in this area? Especially when you know that Austria also claims sovereignty over this whole region, in particular Serbia and Albania and so forth. Yeah.
Because they all claim these areas.
Well, the thing is, you've got these different groups that were profiled based upon their ideologies. And the British were supporting all of these different groups with you know, competing, seemingly contradictory, you know, interests, right? I mean, it's kind of weird that they'd be backing everybody. Unless you understand that they're backing them all because they want to control them all and foment chaos. Because what the British also understood was that Russia had a particular interest in this area and had a defensive alliance with Serbia. Austria was dedicated to never allowing Serbia access to the Adriatic coast or allowing Serbia to expand into this region of Bosnia, Montenegro and Albania and so forth. Well, because that was their domain. I mean, they wanted to annex Serbia. Austrians wanted to annex Serbia. Then you got these wackos called the Young Turks, you know, who were, it's funny, they came in. The leadership, I mean, think of it, they're called the Young Turks, but one of the leading members was a guy named Emmanuel Carasso, who wasn't even Turkish. Another leading member was a guy named Vladimir Jabotinsky, who was a Jew from Russia, who later becomes the ideological father of the Likud party, you know, and the right-wing lunatics in Israel. So you got this Young Turks movement, but nobody's Turkish. Or maybe there's a few Turks, but...
When did Mustafa Kemal come to?
That's afterwards. That's after the war. Yeah. Probably with the fall of the empire at the end of the war. And then,
does he have connection to British?
I'm not sure. I haven't done the work on him yet. But he establishes a modern nation, you know, dividing the division between secular and religious powers and so forth. So I don't really, but I don't know.
But at the same time, this whole region is so rich in terms of culture, and the
history.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, sure.
Well, that's, instead of a war, you can have
Well, yeah, I mean, think about this alternative, which was this railway, the Berlin to Baghdad railway, and how that could have been used to unite these areas. You know, but around development projects. But instead, you get the British coming in and taking the worst aspects of these cultures and helping to put them into positions of power. I mean, the guy who was running, he was from one of the top British families. I mean, a guy named Herbert, forget which one, he was actually, I don't think it was by the Greeks, but by the Albanians. Yeah, the Albanians nationalists, because he helped with the Albanian independence movement, the Albanians offered to make him their king. So it gives you a sense of how much influence they had in this. And at the same time, in Greece, Bulgaria, and Romania, the monarchs of these three countries were all related to Queen, to the British royal family. Yeah, it was, you know, it was a family affair. Mm-hmm. Well, the Young Turks came in, and they overthrew the Ottoman, I don't know what the name of the ruler was at that point. They came in and seized power in 1908, and they started a campaign of ethnic cleansing around 1909, which, well, pisses a few people off, as you can imagine, right? And they start targeting, in particular, these three, the Serbians, the Bulgarians, and the Greeks, and trying to crack down on these populations. So this leads to what are known as the Balkan Wars. Right? And what you get in 1912, Serbia, Bulgaria, and Greece, as well as Montenegro, join together and go to war against the Ottoman Empire. The Ottomans lose. It's a kind of a peace conference. This thing goes on for a couple of years. But then you get a nobody can decide who's going to control this area of Macedonia where all these interests are overlapping. So there's a second Balkan War.
Is there a reason why that's been that area so succeeding?
Well, it has to do... See, the greater Greeks, they look back to, I suppose, a period even maybe around Alexander, to when, you know, the historical boundaries. Yeah, they define these boundaries historically, you know, from a time when they had ruled these regions, and they say, that's going to be ours, we're going to make that ours, we're going to conquer that.
Yeah, and then,
and then you get these British agents coming in there and saying, yeah, you know, you guys really deserve that land. These other guys are assholes, but we'll help you. We'll back you. You know, you've got the backing of the British Empire and your quest to reestablish your historical national boundaries. And they would say that to all of these different players. So after these different Balkan groups had come together to beat the Ottomans, they then have a war amongst themselves over who's going to control this area in here. And at a certain point, Austria gets involved in 1914, and these Serbian radicals decide that, in fact, forget about these other Baltic powers, the real enemy of a greater Serbia is Austria, and in particular, Archduke Franz Ferdinand. This greater Serbia movement. But in fact, it wasn't just a decision that was made by a bunch of guys in Serbia who were a bit angry. This was organized through a network of Freemasonic lodges. Now, get this.
Can you repeat that sentence? It's not just that
a bunch of guys in Serbia decided they were going to assassinate. Like most assassinations, it's never just some lone gunman or somebody who doesn't like a certain policy. But these are generally organized from the top.
Well, what was the premise? Like, what were they? Yeah, I know there was an ulterior motive of your one super. What were they saying the reason was?
That Ferdinand was assassinated?
Yeah, that he should be.
Well, that he opposed this Serbian nationalist movement agenda. That Austria was dedicated to preventing the expansion of Serbia's influence in that region. So these guys decided that Ferdinand had to die, but in fact, the orders came from somewhere else. And there was a trial that took place in 1917 for the guys that had actually killed the Archduke. And so they reported that they were members of the Black Hand, which is a terrorist group, and that their superior in that society, a guy named Milan Stjanović, directed the murder. Interrogation of the accused reveals aspects of how the murder was organized. So you have the president of the court talking with this guy, Princip, who is the guy, I believe, that actually killed Triggerman, yeah. So the president says, "Did you speak with Stjanović about Freemasonry?" Princip, "Why do you ask me?" President, "Because I want to know." Princip, "Yes, Stjanović told me that he was a Freemason. On another occasion, he told me that the heir apparent, Archduke Ferdinand, had been condemned to death by a Freemason's lodge." Defendant, so he says that. Now there's another guy, another one of the Black Hand who's interrogated. So defendant Chabrinović is then examined. He stated that the lodge official who organized the murder was Dr. Radoslav Kazimirović. So Chabrinović says, "He's a Freemason, in some ways one of their heads. He traveled off at once, so soon as Chabrinović and others agreed to do the murder, the Black Hand, and traveled the continent. He was in Budapest, Russia, and France. Whenever I asked Stjanović about our affair, that is the planned murder, he replied, 'When that man comes back.' Then he told me that the Freemasons had condemned the Archduke to death 2 years before, but that no people would carry out the sentence. Afterwards, when he gave the Browning and the cartridges, he said, 'That man came back from Budapest last night. I know the journey had been made in connection with our affair, that he had conferred with certain circles abroad.'" President, "Are you telling us fairy tales?" Chabrinović, "No, it's plain truth. 100 times truer than your documents about the Black Hand." Now, this goes on. In 1917, British author C.H. Norman reported that the Grand Orient Masons were behind the murder of the Archduke in his pamphlet, quote, "Some Secret Influences Behind the War." And he writes, "Somewhere about the year 1906, I was invited to attend a meeting of Englishmen for the purpose of discussing a proposal to form an English lodge of the Grand Orient. The lodge was to be engaged in propaganda on behalf of the Entente Cordiale. With this apparently innocent object, I found myself in sympathy. But nevertheless, I decided to discover whether it was all this benevolent program pretended. To my astonishment, I found the Grand Orient was about to embark upon a vast political scheme in alliance with the Russian Okhrana, the secret police, which could only be brought to fruition by a terrible European war." Norman reported that the Grand Orient included many leading Frenchmen, notably Monsieur Poincaré, who was the wartime president, Combes, Delcasse, Briand, Viviani, and Millerand. He further reported that the London agent of the Grand Orient was involved in planning the murder of the Archduke. And of course, the English monarch is the head of Freemasonry.
As a rule, really?
Yeah.
But
as far as I understand, yeah.
So is Benjamin Franklin.
So they understood that the leader of their secret organization would be monarch.
Yeah, probably. But, I mean, that doesn't necessarily mean that they were a part of the same networks. I mean, we know that Benjamin Franklin set up secret societies in order to organize the revolution. So the mistake is you don't want to make the mistake of just a profile, putting a fixed profile, right? Like Freemason equals satanic worshipping evil bastard or something, or like a member of the oligarchy or the enemy, because it's not necessarily the case. Yeah, no, it's not really. It's more complex than that.
You can always change your mind.
There's also, I mean, people are human beings, and this is also, I mean, a question of scientific method also, because there's a tendency in our society, and you see this a lot with, like, if you watch Zeitgeist, for example, of this connect the dot approach to figuring out these conspiracies, and sometimes you might be able to get something useful out of that, but then you'll also get into these all these wild things like the chemtrails and stuff like that. And you go off and, I mean, you start connecting the dots, and all of a sudden you're at the point where reptilians are controlling everything, and you know, and you can get there very logically and consistently, and you could say, holy shit, you know, and or you could think, or maybe you could think, if you take that approach, that the oligarchy is somehow managing this financial breakdown crisis. But they're not. So this is but that's something that also the work that we're doing on Kepler and scientific method in general is very important
is
for.
Is George Bush a member of the
I don't know, like the Skull and Bones or something like that.
Yeah.
The Skull and Bonehead.
Do you know about the Rothschild family?
Yeah, I've heard of them.
I heard that this guy owns like half of the earth's money.
Maybe.
Yeah. No, he's still here. Right.
What Schiller or Freemason?
I don't know. So, but just to get back here, so you get the murder of the Archduke, because it's not guaranteed yet that World War I was going to happen. Because one thing that the British should learn, and Lord Grey, who actually, I mean, if you want to talk about number two guy for organizing the war, you're talking about Lord Grey, Edward Grey, from back earlier, if you remember his picture.
Sir
Edward Grey. He was the head of the Foreign Office at this time. He was a member of the Round Table Network, which is a bunch of nasty guys. Yeah. Okay. Now, what the British had learned from these two crises over Morocco was that Germany would never take any measures that would mean a war with Britain. That was just... Any time that it came close to that, where the British might get involved, they always backed down. So the Brits knew if they wanted to get their war, they had to make Germany believe that in the case of a German mobilization, Britain would remain neutral. But at the same time, they had these secret arrangements with France and Russia, and they had to make sure that the French and the Russians understood that the British, that they would honor their alliance. Now, on July 26th, George V, who had succeeded Edward VII as king, 1914, sent a message, I believe it was to the ambassador, either the German ambassador to England, somebody close to the Kaiser, indicating that, you know, because Ferdinand had been killed and Austria, tensions were very, very high at that point, that in the case of a war, a German mobilization to back up, because Germany had an alliance with Austria, and Austria was mobilizing for war against Serbia. Okay, so in the event that Germany joined that war on the side of Austria, that Britain would remain neutral. Now, the Kaiser took this as a virtual guarantee and ordered the mobilization of the German army to begin.
Against the French?
Against the French. And what they did almost immediately was they began to move troops into Belgium. Now, if you remember from the Firewall documentary, Belgium had been established as a neutral territory, and that any army that transgressed the borders of Belgium would face a declaration of war from Britain. Now, the Kaiser didn't think that that would happen. I can't remember the treaty exactly. I don't know if they remember, if they mentioned that in the firewall. But it was the German mobilization and the move into Belgium, which the British used as the pretext to declare war. And in fact, and that happened on July 29th. And consider the fact that the order of the mobilization of the armies went as follows. Serbia, Great Britain, Russia, Austria, France, and Germany. Germany was the last army to mobilize for World War I.
Serbia,
Great Britain, Russia, Austria, France, and then Germany.
That's interesting.
That is interesting.
Has been taught something else in Germany.
Yeah, you've been taught that it was the fault of the Germans.
Yeah.
Well, that's one of the biggest lies probably in history. So, yeah. It began with Serbia on July 25th. On July 26th, you had the agreement, or the supposed agreement coming from, or the promise from George V that Britain would stay out. Then on the 29th, as Germany moved troops into Belgium, Churchill, who was the head of the Navy at the time, ordered the mobilization of the British fleet. In secret at midnight. Not at midnight, but he did it in secret. And it wasn't until the next... Churchill. It was on the 28th. On the 29th, the Germans found out. But by then, it was already too late. From that point, Russia, Austria, France, and then Germany mobilized their army.
Churchill.
Yeah, Churchill was the head in the Admiralty at the time. Yeah. And I think it was on August 4th, 5th at midnight on August 4th that Lord Grey, or Sir Edward Grey, actually declared war. So, how do you get World War I? You lie. The British lie. Now, lessons for today. I mean, just think about this, because we're living through a similar period. You've got provocations happening all around the world. Now, we don't necessarily know right now. We don't have the names of particular intelligence agents that are provoking this. We don't know exactly who organized the assassination of Benazir Bhutto. Look at the global dynamic. Tibet. Kosovo. You almost had a war between Colombia and Ecuador, and Venezuela was involved. Kenya, Zimbabwe, Pakistan's a disaster. Afghanistan's a disaster. Threats against Iran. You know, British leading the attack against Russia right now to isolate Russia. I mean, you just start looking at this, the isolation of China. You've got a global dynamic. This is not, you know, a statistical accumulation of burning trees. this is a process we're seeing, right? History is not driven by events. The events are generated by a process. And the process in this case is an intention to launch a new war akin to World War I at a time when this financial system is collapsing. Right, when the threat is that we could see a resurgence of this American system again. Yeah. Consider the fact that the British are now mobilizing against a system of economy which does not actually exist on this planet. Because that's what they're mobilizing against. Some people say it explicitly, like Tony Blair gave a speech in 2004, which we covered maybe a couple months ago. He said, you know, since the late 90s, I've been searching for a philosophy to replace the Westphalian system, the Westphalian concept.
What's wrong with the Westphalian?
Well, some people don't like it so much, like Blair. But the Westphalian concept is of sovereign nation state, acting in a certain common interest. People like Kissinger talk about how the world is now moving into the post-Westphalian era. This is what the Lisbon Treaty is about in Europe.
Did they explicitly say what they call the replacement?
Well, some people, like this one guy, Giulio Amato, who was one of the crafters of the Lisbon Treaty, he openly advocates feudalism. That's their model, is feudalism, where you break up the nation states, replace them with a city-state system in which the cities are themselves controlled by financial interests, by financial power. And we essentially eliminate all of the progress that's been made in the last 600 years. That's what these guys are talking about.
Do you know how they call it?
How they call it?
Yeah, how do they call it?
Well,
what's their terminology for it?
Well,
do you know it?
Have they given it a name, a new name?
Yeah,
new
that's what I'm asking, so I could recognize what they're
yeah.
About.
Well, no, they. I mean,
well,
here's the problem, right?
Really smart,
they're not so stupid to go around talking about how,
no,
hey guys, we're going to establish a world empire.
Yeah.
They don't talk about that. But you'll hear post-Westphalian system. They talk about that. They discuss it in negative terms, in a sense. Some people were more explicit, like H.G. Wells and Bertrand Russell. You know, these guys, they were openly talking about world government. You see, the thing is, the repercussions. Because after this, I mean, to get a sense of the devastation, right? You know, I found some wild pictures. I'm sure you guys have probably seen some of this before, like the trench warfare and things like that, and what was happening.
Yeah.
I mean, these trenches were brutal. I mean, totally inhuman. Now, this is interesting. A city in France before the war. After the war. Something like 90% of the Russian troops were either killed or wounded.
90%?
Or maybe not quite that high, but... sorry, no. 76%.
That's the official count.
Yeah. Right, out of 12 million men mobilized by Russia, over 9 million were either killed, wounded, or taken prisoner or missing, which, I mean, missing is pretty much killed, right? But so how many total casualties? 37 million. So this, and what was the outcome of this war? Well,
good guess.
The establishment of the largest empire in the history of the world. Note, giant.
You know, play some Maple Leaf there also.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Everything at that point was the biggest it ever was.
Yeah. the 1920s leading up to World War II was the greatest extent of the British Empire.
Oh,
God.
Right.
Now, you know, this... I'm not going to be going into this, but just in the broad sweep of history, and LaRouche talks about this plenty, and we've written a lot on it, and there's lots of material available. The entire century was defined by this conflict. And it's been only in the last few years that the world has begun to pick itself up from where we left off. Now, we put out this report, the Eurasian Land Bridge, in 1997, to organize Russia and China and India and other Eurasian nations around building, taking up the project of these patriots of the 19th century again, as a way of overcoming this imperial system. Now, a certain fellow out of the Cambridge and Oxford circles of geopolitics wrote an article in 1996, and here's where you see that you got to understand history in terms of centuries if you want to really understand what's going on right now, because the enemy, right, the guys are trying to organize this new war, they do think in terms of centuries. You know, King Edward spent most of his life organizing World War I. Okay? Now, this guy wrote, it's regarding a certain set of projects that had been launched in 1996 around railroad development. He says, this Euro-Asian railroad project involving China, Iran, and other countries requires us to revive Alfred Mackinder and basic geopolitics. This has enormous geopolitical and strategic potential and is a real danger because, as you can see, it is not accessible to the Anglo-American maritime powers.
This is 1996.
Now, think when I think of maritime powers, now I think of aircraft carriers. What is the range for aircraft, sea-based aircraft, in terms of bombing campaigns and so forth?
400 miles.
Something like that, you know. But I mean, a plane based off of a U.S. ship in the Persian Gulf, I don't know if it would be capable of bombing Central Asia. Yeah, well, this is the thing of why it's still an issue of this overland development. What worries me is the economic multiplier effects of building railways. There's an enormous multiplier effect in terms of materials and logistical infrastructure. Think of the implications of this for movements of troops and materials. The United States should be very worried about such developments. We've come full circle now in the 20th century. It began with a Eurasian geopolitical threat and is ending with one. Go back to why Mackinder wrote his Geographical Pivot of Political History, which was published in Geographical Journal, the magazine of the Royal Geographical Society. It's not accidental that this was written in 1904, just as the Russo-Japanese War was beginning. What motivated him to write it was the building of the Trans-Siberian Railway. Now we've come full circle. Go back to the works of Haushofer, Hitler's advisor. He had one of the great geopolitical designs, the so-called inner line, free of Anglo-Saxon influence. It was a great design, but Hitler blew it with Operation Barbarossa. When I hear about China linking up with Iran in building a railway and Russia becoming interested, I see this as the recreation of that interlying design in a new form. This must be monitored extremely closely. Please, go back and read your Mackinder. This is what he was warning about. The individual is not named, but a leading British military strategist, July 1996. Well, Mackinder was the guy who, in a sense, wrote a book about what Edward VII was doing. What he identified was that world politics will revolve around this area. He called this the heartland, Eastern Europe and into Central Asia, because of the resources, because of the population, and what he recognized was that the greatest threat to the British Empire was the potential for the establishment of powerful land-based nations, which could develop in regions which were inaccessible to British maritime power. And that if the British Empire wanted to continue to dominate, it had to prevent at all costs the rise of those types of nations. Today that's identified as obviously Russia, China, India, and the United States. So when you see the confrontation developing between China and the US and Britain, this is what we're talking about. Who's orchestrating these events? We're in a massive crisis. Whose interest is it to foment chaos? Not in our interest. Whose system is now bankrupt? The physical economy is not what is bankrupt. Our capacity to produce food, produce physical goods, is not bankrupt. It's been severely mauled and beaten down, but we can rebuild that. What is bankrupt is the system of the oligarchy, and they're freaking out. What they think is that the only way... See, look, you know, what I want to end with, and is a part of LaRouche's recent paper on the Brutish Empire.
Brutish?
The Brutish Empire, yeah. Because, I mean, what is the frame of mind of these guys at this point? And the thing is, why are we saying that, in fact, the oligarchy is not in control and they're doomed? But the question for us is whether or not we're going to go down with them. You know, he said many times, these guys can't win. The only thing they can do is destroy civilization. If they try to impose fascism, if they try to get a giant Eurasian war going, you know, if a few billion people are wiped out, which is possible under these policies that they're trying to implement right now. If that happens, we lose and they lose. Because they're not going to be able to manage this crisis. The British circles that put Hitler into power, this Anglo-American circle, they couldn't even control Hitler. And you're going to try to unleash global chaos like what they're talking about right now? You're going to target a billion Muslims? I mean, the Muslim world knows that there's a war against Iran. For them, this is a new religious war. They see it in that way. I mean, what are the consequences? You can't control that. And they're going to try to unleash that? This is where you come back to tragedy again. You know, and you've got to ask the question, well, are we going to capitulate to that? Are we going to be like the populations of Europe that allowed these fools to lead them open-eyed into World War I? Or are we going to find a higher concept of identity, of mission, that can overcome that? Like reestablishing the Westphalian principle. Right, that nations have an obligation to recognize and promote the benefit of other nations, the advantage of other nations. You know, LaRouche, he's put out so many policies on economic development, whether it's for the Middle East, for China, for Russia, for South America, as things that could be implemented to overcome whatever difference, whether it's the Balkans or anywhere else. These can be enacted. The only thing holding us back is the population in the West right now that seems to say to us on the street, well, yes, I hear what you're saying, but I would rather die.
Die fighter, die then.
Then
die fighter.
Then, say civilization. I would rather die than do anything serious politically.
Or they just say that it's not going to happen.
Yeah. But what they're really saying, if you understand tragedy, is we prefer to die.
I feel hopeless, harmed.
Yeah, that's what they say and that's what they feel. Right?
If you will, that's learned helplessness.
Yeah, they've imposed it upon themselves.
Yeah.
They've accepted that. See, and our mission as young people is to break the population out of that. Is to choose to not die. Right? To not allow our civilization to collapse. Now, we may not, personally die, but as civilization goes, what kind of future do we have? And even for kids who know, they don't even like school, know they're not really learning very much. It's rotting this. One friend of mine, he actually told us once here at a meeting how he felt like whenever he was in school, he felt his soul rotting. But the thing is, he should be a member, but why isn't he? What holds him back? Why do people choose what may seem to be their immediate self-interest, but in the end is what destroys them? And this is what LaRouche is getting at here. So we can read this, and then there can be discussion, or we can go from there. If people have questions also, because the history is a bit can be convoluted. If somebody wants to read this, I can make that bigger, actually.
Yeah, you just said something rather quickly, but I think it's pretty important that people choose what seems to be their immediate self-interest, but in the end, it's what ends up killing them.
That idea with the monkey and
the monkey? Yeah, the Malaysian monkey
the
trap.
Monkey.
I tried to find a picture of the Malaysian monkey trap, but I just found some weird plastic monkey with a... It didn't work very well, but I was looking for it.
May I read it?
But that is the issue. Absolutely, yeah.
All right. All imperial systems and character systems depend for the conditional durability on stifling those creative powers of the human individual, which are expressed typically in the form of discovery of universal physical principles or comparable intellectual qualities of classical artistic activity. The design is intended to degrade the great mass of humanity as virtual cattle to a condition of mental life in which human mental life is brought to resemble the farmer's herd of cattle. This effect is accomplished simply by outlawing mental activity tantamount to knowledge of fire, or better said today, nuclear fission. It was on this account that the legendary Olympian Zeus of Aeschylus condemned Prometheus to quasi-permanent torture for confiding knowledge of the use of fire to those intended Delphic cattle known as mortal man and woman. Such Malthusian or kindred policy of practice encounter an existentially crucial problem for the society which harbors such trickery. Any society operating on a fixed technological level is doomed on that account, but any culture which promotes the creative powers of its general population is one which will come around sooner or later to overthrowing oligarchical modalities. Thus, the British Empire, if it wishes to remain an empire, must suppress actual creativity in the generality of the subject population, or cease to be tolerated as an empire, thus creating a situation in which the British must either give up their imperial tradition, or be doomed by the consequences of suppressing scientific progress as a characteristic of morality of its own population. That is, catch 22, the British must monopolize scientific technological progress in order to stupefy its subject population, which it must do to remain an empire. Yet, if it does not promote that scientific and technological progress to practice in such a general way that the potential productive powers of the general labor force keep ahead of the rate of attrition inherent in a fixed level of technology, the empire will undergo a physical collapse as is witnessed by the general history of imperial and similar attempts at zero technological growth consistency. Lately, the combination of the increase in population, especially among the relatively poor masses into which much of production has been shifted away from the formerly industrialized powers, with the falling overall productivity caused by this outsourcing, has produced a fall in per capita and per square kilometer rate of net physical output, which will doom the present civilization if continuation of that approximately net zero growth policy were permitted. Currently, the world is operating below technological break-even on this account for precisely this set of reasons. The empire, just because it is an empire in terms of the embedded cultural characteristics of its reigning institutions, is probably doomed simply for the reason that it would prefer to die than abandon those features of its embedded cultural reflexes which define it as an empire. For the rest of us, the question is, do we prefer to go down with the empire or to cut free from both its physical and, more important, cultural embrace?
That is the question.
The cultural embrace.
Did that make sense what you said there in terms of the economics? Like, why this thing is doomed? You know, they see these oligarchs, they can't
attempt.
Even buy... Hmm?
I'm making an attempt.
Okay.
Since the empire rests on keeping the population down and the mental activity,
mm-hmm.
they also cut short the potential for physical growth and for growth of development, of economic development.
Yeah.
And so the very foundation on which the civilization rests is not nurtured.
Mm-hmm.
And so the whole thing will break down in the end.
Yeah.
Is that what it's meant?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. You can see that right now in the collapse of the financial system, which was triggered by the collapse of the U.S. housing market. That what has happened over the last 30 to 40 years is that we have undercut our capacity to produce in the West and at the same time maintain the equivalent standard of living that we had when we were producing. We artificially maintained in a way by not only going into massive amounts of debt but also by crushing production in other nations.
Yep.
Crushing nations that were trying to develop themselves as the United States had developed itself through upgrading its population. And we imposed these cheap labor systems upon them. Yep. Our friend Albert here can tell stories about what has been done to Africa in the name of colonialism and cheap raw materials. Right? So this system, that's the thing, it is necessary for the continuation of the system, it is necessary to continually cannibalize itself. And this is where fascism becomes necessary for the system. Yeah. It's easy to make somebody take a wage cut if you're pointing a machine gun at them. It's amazing how many concessions people will make under those conditions. And that's the issue right now.
So what do you do about it?
Well, I mean, look at what our youth movement is doing. Because in the end, we've got this corrupt population. We have to ennoble these people. What we also know through history is that revolutions, successful revolutions, are run by young people. Our age, or younger sometimes. So it comes down to a decision that you make to not capitulate to the popular culture. But see, even if, you know, and this is something that we all need to think about. For example, what if we lose? What if the oligarchy is to win? What if they get their war? What if everything goes to hell? Does that mean you don't fight? Because think about it. To the extent that humanity in the future has the potential to organize a renaissance depends upon what we do now. Even if we never see the renaissance. Look at LaRouche, for example. The guy's going to be 86 in September. And he's pumping out papers like you wouldn't believe. I mean, the guy probably works 18 hours, 19 hours a day. He will never see the world that he has fought his entire life to create. Unless there's some miracle and we can cryogenically freeze him or something like that. But that's doubtful. I'm not sure. Maybe I don't even know if you want that. I don't know. And yet, what is driving him to do what he's doing? You know, at his age, he could retire and say, "Look, I did my part. Everything's fucked up." But he's not. He's actually fighting harder now than ever before. You know, to organize circles around the world to break with this system. You know, identifying what's going on. You know, identifying who's orchestrating things. You know, alerting people to know, who are you being played by? Who's trying to destroy you? Or who's trying to get you to destroy yourself?
And whose interest is it?
Yeah, exactly.
What would the interest be?
Right.
That's an interesting question.
And people around the world have picked up. Like, Putin and his circles know it's the British. They're fairly open about this stuff in some of their statements. You know, the Chinese are probably starting to catch on now that they also have been targeted.
Yeah.
And this is, yeah, and this is one of the reasons why in Russia and China, Russia more so than China, we're getting widespread coverage. Hundreds of news internet sites are covering LaRouche's statements, also other articles that we're publishing on, you know, the whole strategic crisis. So, I mean, that's what you can do. But, you know, we have to ennoble the population. And what we're doing with our science program, what we're doing with economics, is laying the foundation for any renaissance which is going to come in the future. Just like all through history. I mean, most of humanity and most of the humanists and great thinkers lived in times of dark ages. I mean, Plato never saw his republic, but he still wrote his works, knowing that in the future, that republic has a greater chance of being established with him having written his works than if he never wrote them. And to situate yourself in that way in history, not in some linear sense, but in the sense of living eternally with all of these great minds out of the past and all of humanity. I mean, think about the entire weight of humanity and humanity's actions have had to occur in order to bring us to this room. And you can get a sense of the responsibility we have now to ensure that that, as Lincoln said, that was not in vain. But I think we can win, because the oligarchs are pretty dumb. They're using the same tricks today they used 100 years ago.
That's a tragedy. People don't want to learn from these tricks. They
erase in a way that they still believe in.
Well, they believe in illusions, and that's the thing. You've got it. When you look at the time we're in now, you have to understand it from the standpoint of this last century. You know, this book that JP read from earlier, The Prolegomenon, this paper that LaRouche wrote last September, if you haven't got a copy, you should take one, because we have thousands and we don't know what to do with them. You should take one and you should read this, and it's very interesting because he starts the work, just like he starts many of his speeches, saying, look, you've got to understand what occurred when Roosevelt died, and how the United States and the West in general was subverted, its culture was subverted and turned on its head, perverted, actually is a better word. It was completely perverted in order to create the conditions of a mass fascist culture where people like Al Gore would be cool and people would willingly accept policies that are destroying their lives.
Actually, I still don't know what the problem with Al Gore was.
Well, I mean, Al Gore's solution, Al Gore thinks the problem is there's too many people. He also wildly denies the role of nuclear power. You can have environmentalists, and you do have some, who say we've got an environmental crisis, therefore we need nuclear power. So you got people like Gore, who's really just a racist. Just like the people who...
The
thing is, it's what he doesn't say, for one thing, okay? Because he's against nuclear power. He's against development in Africa. Although, he'll give them windmills or solar panels. But he won't allow them to have high-speed trains. He won't let them have nuclear power.
Which is implicated in that he would give them solar panels because that wouldn't work for high-speed trains.
You know, Gore also prevented South Africa from developing generic AIDS drugs back in the late 90s, which meant people died. Yeah.
Like, why haven't we cured AIDS still?
Yeah.
Like a little while ago, it was a good example of global warming. This room was pretty hot.
Uh-huh.
And we did something and it's really cool.
Yeah.
But he's really just a guy. I mean, you gotta look at this guy, historically where he comes from. You know, what he's done, but especially what he doesn't say.
But he's saying it in the last book,
It's overpopulation. That's essentially the issue with right. But don't forget, the guy owns a hedge fund. He profiteers off of carbon trading. So he makes his money off of selling global warming. No conflict of interest there. He's also in the paid employment of the British Parliament as a special advisor on the environment. So, you know, we've published a lot on Gore, but this is the thing. I mean, this whole thing of global warming is a fraud. The guy doesn't want to talk. He doesn't want to actually have any dialogue or debate on these questions. He just wants to go in and say there's a consensus. We have to do things now. And basically what he says we have to do is shut down industrial civilization. Now, the thing is, the implications of that is that the human population collapses, I don't know, a couple billion people, a billion people?
50 years.
Probably you'd have to go back to the population levels that we had before the Industrial Revolution. Because it was the Industrial Revolution which has allowed us to have the kind of population levels that we have today. Right? As Lynn says here, the increase in the potential relative population density, right? The increase of the support of the ability to support increasing numbers of people per square kilometer. And that's what these guys they don't understand. You know, that these policies will doom us if we carry them out. So.
Again, if these people who would, when we talk about imperialists...
We can turn the lights on also.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when we talk about imperialists or like that, and you said earlier they are using the same tricks again.
Yeah.
Just wondering, in a thought experiment, if it was possible to get an access to put them all into one big house, I don't know, like Bilderberg in one hotel, and be able to get an opening so that information can really be transmitted and it's not filtered by all kinds of beliefs.
Try to get them to...
Would that...
People?
I mean,
if you open alternative possibilities to enrich this living on this planet, I can't get around and saying they won't get something out of it or would see there are alternatives. I don't like the idea of that they just evil or would not be interested in changing things if they saw that they could win too as human beings.
Well, yeah, I mean, as human beings.
But that's a question of identity probably, isn't it?
Yeah.
But okay. That's the control aspect. That's the slave aspect. That's the way I see it or understand it. That there are people who are addicted to having other people do their work for
them. That's as powerless as we are, isn't it? Because it's as much not in responsibility as it's the victim state, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
As much as most of the people on the street who say we can't do anything about it.
Well, you know, I think
so. That would be the same thing, basically.
Well, I think the oligarchs are the biggest slaves of all.
That's what you said earlier, yeah. Like you mentioned Rockefeller and
mm-hmm.
his funds,
yeah.
or their funds in that case,
mm-hmm.
became more important than the individual's well-being.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean. It may be possible to reform these oligarchs. Hopefully they can be reformed because we cannot risk having them around, you know, with the way that they're thinking right now. At least not shaping policy.
No.
Very.
But I think it would be a skip. I mean, maybe the best thing for them would be to all just stick them on an island together. Think about it. They would be so miserable.
They don't know how to
imagine if we made them totally impotent, totally powerless, and yet they all had to live with each other. I mean, it would be crazy. But
that's where Arnie would come up.
Maybe.
You see, sometimes you have people like Roosevelt. He's coming from where he got to go. He's a good guy. Okay. You have people like Mendeleev, you know, the great scientist, you know, coming from one of the oldest family in Russia. So the thing is, you know, he was the grandfather of Russia. So the thing is, you know, you look in history, so good people, between the bad people too.
Yeah.
The thing is, they have their own potential. And
yes.
They have to give them an opportunity to rescue them. You know, that's the key idea. You don't want to be naive. Violence as a person is not the best human being in the world, but insofar as the potential for her to become an effective leader and deal with crises, that's what you identify, that she can change. But you want to be like, oh, people are good, you know, everything will be great, it's really about the people. That's really the way you want to look at it. That's the whole thing. Animals can't change, and they can't generate.
Yeah.
A friend of mine said, maybe we should take all these people, put them in one house and love them. Maybe that would change something.
Well, they need something.
Yeah, that's cool,
right?
That's the end goal.
They need something. yeah.
However that would look like.
Yeah, it's, I know, it's kind of, I mean, part of the problem also, it has to be understood also as a religious question, that, or it takes the form of a religious question, or a form of religious fundamentalism, the way that they think about the universe, just like a tragedy, you know, they're, really, for us, it's a matter of whether or not we will allow them to act out this tragedy for all of humanity, or on behalf of us all, or whether or not we're going to intervene to just ensure that they're just a bunch of people on a stage which can't influence the rest of the planet. I think that they really are doomed, these guys. In the future, humanity is going to get out of this. But these guys, I think of them as a bunch of drug addicts, really. Just totally debased drug addicts. They have no control. And for them, see, the thing is, they are so corrupted, from what I understand. Like LaRouche is saying, they can't even conceive of not having their oligarchy. Because what is the purpose of their existence? It's to live as an oligarchy.
Yes, perpetuating their own.
Yeah.
It's like, Macbeth?
Yeah, Macbeth is also in point. Shakespeare, I mean, he's... you want to learn statecraft, it's Shakespeare, right? There's a very famous scene in which Macbeth is talking with his wife about he's planning out the murder of his general Banquo, who's also his good friend, probably his best friend, and she's rather horrified by this. She had had no involvement in the planning of it. She'd helped him plan the previous murders that he committed. She'd actually run him for a while, but now he's orchestrating murders on his own. And she asks him why it's necessary, and he replies that by that point he's so steeped in blood that to turn back is as painful as to go on, to renounce everything that he's done
and get nailed for it,
because everything that he wanted was he wanted the crown. He was willing to do anything to win the crown of Scotland, and once he got it, he realized that to keep it, he had to keep committing these murders, because he was a usurper. So that's the catch-22. Do I give up everything that I've desired in life and save my soul, or keep committing these crimes and keep what I have and maybe come out on top? Maybe I'll make it through and I'll save my kingdom. But of course, maybe I won't. But at least there's a chance there in his mind that he could actually win. But if he gives it up, he can't win. But see, with LaRouche, you've got an added dimension, which is science. That there are physical, what he calls boundary conditions, in the sense of you have universal principles that cannot be defied. Even the oligarchy, which doesn't believe in universal principles, whether it's of science or statecraft or art, they themselves cannot deny the principles they deny to exist. They cannot defy the principles. And that's an important point. Because they will try to defy them. But they can't. And what they hope to impose upon the planet cannot work for those reasons. So, this is where, you know, we have a lot of work to organize the population and make sure that the leadership of today and the youth of today don't make these same mistakes. And we got to make fun of them a lot, too. Because that always helps. I don't know, does anybody else have any questions about the history or anything else? Or general comment?
Yeah, actually, Rob, there was one thing I was wondering. H.G. Wells, you had that book for world government,
World War I,
right? And that didn't work. That was rejected, shot down by all these supposed nations. Said, no, this is not the first nation thing. And we submit our sovereignty.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that would be the same for people, so they shot it down. That didn't work. Do you know why that didn't work?
Remember, I mean, the domination, it's a Venetian model, and you control, you don't really have real power over other countries your power, you have power proportional to the extent that you can influence these countries and deceive them and manipulate them and so forth. But I think one key aspect of this is that the culture, the general culture, or Western culture at that time, is far less degenerate than it is today. The overall culture. Because the leadership is always reflected. The League of Nations, that was organized around the Versailles Treaty.
I was thinking of the precursor.
The European Constitution. And that was shot down, yeah.
How long ago was that?
2005, I believe.
So Lisbon fails and we can look forward to other...
Well, potentially, yeah. And that...
The NATO Constitution.
The what?
The NATO Constitution.
Yeah, NATO Constitution.
Free world government.
Mm-hmm.
I usually it's not very good, so I will try to
find it.
Did you heard about Helium 3 and the moon?
Helium 3 and the moon?
Yes. This project and what it means for you, the planet?
I'm not sure. No, I don't think
the best both about that one. The big gas you can use for your planet.
Oh, Helium 3, yeah, yeah, for fusion.
Yes?
Yeah, I've heard a little bit about that. Yeah. We should have these kinds of programs.
Because I know in Belarus, it seems that atomic energy is very important, and
mm-hmm.
the level of energy. That what I understand is the technology, when the technology will be available to use
mm-hmm.
helium-3 on the moon. Well, I know some. Somebody who is a doctor in physics
mm-hmm.
told me maybe we will have those technologies in 50 years or so.
Mm-hmm.
For me, the moon will be the gas station for the Earth. Not for 200 years, but for millions of years.
Yeah.
So he told me also that maybe this will be the real reason for the next world war.
Yeah.
And
well, potentially.
And there are many moons in our solar system, also many planets. There's a lot of precious.
At the same time, these are it's like a Mars program, right? We could say that the colonization of Mars could be the basis for a new war over who's going to dominate it, right? But when I think about it, I don't think it would be possible for us to either mine the moon or go to Mars without a fundamental transformation of... We need to get the Westphalian system re-established on Earth as the basis for getting to the Moon or Mars again.
Yeah.
What it's going to take for fusion, right, is an international science driver program. Or there's a focus by governments on massive investment into research and development and so forth. But it's going to have to be organized. But also, the oligarchy would never let it happen. The oligarchy organizes the wars. They would never want that to happen. Because the kind of optimism that that this would create would virtually doom them. You know?
Like the very process of being able to get to a technological level where we could do it requires the type of process that we're fighting for. It's actually just a healthy process of time. So when you start to train people to think scientifically in that way, that they can make the discoveries that are necessary to mine the moon or to go to Mars, you're already engaged in a process that moves people away from empire and domination. Yeah. So like those types of programs or projects, whatever type of programs, or the types of projects that will actually feed and nurture the American system of political economy. opposed to the population reduction idea of the empire. Right? If you start killing off everybody, then you're lessen your chance of going to the world. If you learn how to efficiently increase your population, then you're engaged in a process where maybe you can get to the sooner rather than later.
Also, too, you can't let that fear paralyze you. Yeah. They could have said the same thing before the transcontinental rail development in America. Like they could have said, "Holy shit, you know, this is the end of the huge war. That's going to provoke them. Let's not do that. You know, we don't want another war right now. Definitely going to provoke them. Then, you know, they're going to come after us. They're going to cause shit if we do this." They did, but you know, not really a reason.